Chapter 9, The Exhausted Millennial Parent. It's easy to see how having a kid can exacerbate all of the tendencies, anxieties, and exhaustion that characterize millennial burnout. But it's another thing, especially if you don't have kids, to try to understand how that exacerbation actually feels. You think you have it under control until something throws it all off and you have a breakdown, Lisa, a mother of two from suburban Pennsylvania, told me. You suddenly realize your kid's shoes are two sizes too small and you burst into tears. You're a horrible mom who has abused her kid because you were caught up in the day-to-day. Toddlers never tell you when shoes are too tight. You agree to split the weekend with your spouse and he goes off golfing for 7 hours and you are so filled with rage when he gets home that you don't even care that tomorrow is your day because you have nothing planned and don't know what you would do because there are no female hobbies that last 7 hours. It's the kind of exhaustion where you can't really have other feelings, Lauren, who recently moved from the U.S. to Britain, explained. I'd wake up some mornings and just stare out my window, wanting to cry. But mostly I didn't have the luxury of having feelings. Either I'd get told, this is what being a mom is like, or some kind of authority would come around for concerned looks and postpartum depression quizzes. I don't think I was ever a danger to my kids. I think I was just exhausted, given no help, and blamed for any feelings of resentment in my life. Parenting burnout makes me feel like I don't want to take care of anyone anymore, ever, Amy, who's white and lives in a major American city, said. I don't want to have to remember the minutiae of anyone's day. I find myself being irritable and short-fused with my kids over the smallest things. I tend to lose perspective on the socks that have been left in the middle of the living room for so long, and I can easily fly off the handle if I'm asked for one more thing in the middle of the 7 others I'm already doing. I hate that I resent my husband for getting to work outside the home and having the privilege of forgetting that he was supposed to be home at a certain time because he got caught up with work. At times, I feel too small for the momentous title of mom. I'm not quite on board with the concept of burnout, Jenny, who parents in a small town in a Western state, explained. It's like that quote from David Foster Wallace about goldfish and water. One fish asks another fish, how's the water? The other fish replies, what the hell is water? Historically, parents have been forced to make decisions about which child will have to drop out of school to work or which child will get more food. Those choices are gruesome and have never been easy, but they have always been acknowledged as such. Contemporary parenting culture, meanwhile, is a particularly complicated and deceptive kind of difficult, made all the more so because its difficulty is often denied or erased. It enforces ideals that are impossible to achieve within our current caregiving scenarios and squares the blame for societal failures on individual parents. It breeds resentment and despair, particularly for women who place stock in the idea of an equal partnership. Similar to the paradigm of overwork, it equates exhaustion with skill or aptitude or devotion. The best parents are the ones who give until there's nothing left of themselves. And worst of all, there's little evidence that it actually makes kids' lives better. Instead of the problem that has no name, famously described in Betty Friedan's landmark 1963 book, The Feminine Mystique, this problem has a name, and that name is parenting burnout. It's the result of shifting ideas about what constitutes good parenting, stubborn ideas about whose labor gets counted, and the overflow of work outside of the workplace. But first and foremost, it's an outgrowth of the fact that American society is still arranged as if every family has a caretaker who stays home, even as fewer and fewer families are arranged that way. Parenting burnout does not uniquely affect mothers. But because mothers continue to perform the vast majority of the labor in homes with a mother and a father, it affects mothers most. The burden only increases when you consider growing rates of single parenthood. As of 2017, about 1/5 of the children in the United States lived with a solo mother. Just because women have been liberated from many of the explicit forms of subjugation and sexism that accompanied domestic life, other forms continue to thrive, sublimated into the ideologies of ideal contemporary womanhood. Today's mothers are expected to gracefully manage and maintain a high-pressure job, her children, her relationship, her domestic space, and her body. She is free to be pressured to be everything to everyone at all times, save herself. But how did it get this way? Squint at your parents' parenting practices, and you can see the outlines of what have become the expensive, anxious, and paranoid parenting practices of today. First, there was the fear of the ever more dangerous world and the accompanying threats to children's well-being. Those threats could be subverted, but only through vigilance and knowledge, which gradually translated into total surveillance of our children, but also of other people's parenting practices. Second, there was the fear of downward mobility, that a family's class position was unstable and pouring literal or figurative resources into children was the only way to try to protect against that slippage. Burnt out boomer parents felt it. Now their burnt out millennial children feel it as well. Cue even more amped up versions of the concerted cultivation that guided many middle-class childhoods, complete with packed schedules, bonus enrichment, and college planning that starts before birth. The necessity of which are reinforced through the Instagram accounts, Facebook parenting threads, blogs, newsletters, podcasts, and parenting books that fill bourgeois mothers' media diets. But that doesn't entirely answer the question of how it got this bad for mothers in particular. The answer, of course, is patriarchy. But patriarchy cloaked in the deceptive language of equality and progress. As multiple historians have shown, women have long resented the mundane, stultifying tasks of domesticity, but rarely dared to contradict the public understanding of the joyful, self-abnegating mother. When women started entering the professional workplace in the 1960s and 70s, the freedom and choice which had long been allotted to men came into sharp relief. Not all women wanted lives outside the domestic sphere, but many women wanted the choice. Of course, millions of poor women, especially Black and Brown women, had been working outside of the home for generations. They just did it, as so many poor people do now, in workplaces that were informal, someone else's home, or unstable, migrant farm work. But when white middle-class women started doing it, and in the same spaces as white middle-class men, well, that was cause for alarm. Alarm, but also stability. For many families, a supplemental income was a godsend. But that stability was offset by the shame of the husband no longer being able to uniquely provide for his family and all other manner of fragile masculinity manifestations. And how do you make men feel better about their masculinity? You assure them that nothing really will change. A woman might be working in the office 8 hours a day, but she'll still be feminine and put together. And dinner will still be served at the same time, and the kids won't even notice a thing. In other words, she'll still be a full-time housewife, even if she's also a full-time worker outside the home. Hence the second shift, a term popularized by Arlie Russell Hochschild's 1989 book of the same name, to describe the fact that these mothers were in fact pulling double shifts every day, one in the formal workplace, then another back at home. Hochschild argues that women's entrance into the paid economy was the basic social revolution of our time. But as she pointed out, the feminist component of that revolution was largely stalled. Just because women were shouldering equal amounts of work outside the home didn't mean that the work inside the home was equally split as well. As a result, the first shift, a mother's job outside the home, was often compromised or devalued in order to keep maintaining the second one in the home. One shift fathers, by contrast, could continue to cultivate their careers unimpeded. Granted, these fathers did perform more domestic work than their own fathers. Between 1965 and 2003, men's portion of unpaid family work rose from under 20% to nearly 30%. But since 2003, that figure has remained stubbornly in place. Time use studies by the Bureau of Labor Statistics find that women who work for pay outside the home still shoulder 65% of childcare responsibilities. Fathers, in other words, have never even approached performing an equal amount of household labor. Societal programs have not addressed the shift toward the dual parent work model, even as fewer and fewer families have a stay-at-home parent today. In America, there is still no mandatory paid parental leave. Subsidized and affordable childcare is difficult, if not impossible, to find. Schools run for just 3/4 of the year and 2/3 of the workday, short, the societally compelled rhythms of a child's day and year are incompatible with the rhythms of most parents' working life. In the past, even when millennials were children, this incompatibility was largely manageable. A kid could come home from school and hang out with a grandparent or a slightly older sibling, or go to the neighbor's house. Some were latchkey kids, named for keys worn around their necks, who'd spend hours at home after school before a parent returned from work. The cultural stereotypes around these kids soon became plagued with sweeping indictments on how this alone time could corrupt their character. Kids left alone started fires. They were lonely. They watched too much television. They ended up on a path toward juvenile delinquency. And with that image came an increasingly critical view of the parents who allowed their children to be at home unsupervised. Today, we have even more working mothers and a dearth of childcare alternatives. But instead of returning to looser standards of supervision or altering work hours, we've mandated constant supervision. Many elementary schools won't release a child after school or even allow them off a school bus without an approved adult present. To allow your late elementary school-aged child to come home to an empty house is, as several people from across the country told me, to risk getting reported to CPS. It doesn't matter if you, as a parent, think your child has the ability to safely be at home by herself. Other adults will report you. As Kim Brooks points out in Small Animals, Parenthood in the Age of Fear, when Barbara W. Sarnecka, a cognitive scientist at USC Irvine, allowed her third grader to play after school at an adjacent park with many adults present, but not herself, another parent emailed her husband, and the principal of the elementary school emailed her. Brooks also recalls the fallout after she made the decision to leave her four-year-old in her car for 5 minutes while she ran into the store to grab a pair of headphones. The police didn't catch her. Someone in the parking lot, someone she'd never met and never would, taped her on their cell phone and then submitted the videotape to the police. As with all things parenting, the standards are most exacting amongst middle-class, urban, and suburban parents. And while white middle-class parents often do the policing, they're also the ones most likely to avoid criminal consequences for their actions. As Brooks points out, when she was charged with contributing to the delinquency of a minor in the state of Virginia, she was able to afford the sort of nice clothes that signaled to a prosecutor and judge, "I'm not a threat to my children or society." She was also able to afford a good lawyer who made the process as seamless as possible, and earned her a sentence of community service and a parenting class. She endured the social censure and the sense of shame, but that was nothing compared to what would have happened to her or her children if she wasn't a white middle-class woman. Which is why the new standard, enforced by teachers and principals and parents and their peers, is that if a parent can't alter their schedule in order to pick up and supervise their child after school, the understanding is that they'll pay someone else or some service to do it for them. The stats bear this out. Census data shows that between 1997 and 2013, the number of grade school American children who spent time alone after school went down by nearly 40%, from 1 in 5 kids in 1997 to 1 in 9 in 2013. Part of that shift can be linked to increased work flexibility. Parents' jobs take up more hours, but some of those hours can be shifted around, which in practice usually just makes for more work, or distracted parenting. And part of it can be attributed to increased availability of after-school programs, many funded by private-public partnerships like the After School Alliance, which was founded in 2000. To be clear, there's nothing wrong with after-school programs. They're great. In many low-income areas, they're fully subsidized. But for millions of American families, paying for them is a burden. In one New Jersey school district, a parent told me they have no control over whether their kindergartner attends school in the morning or afternoon. If they need full-day school, it's an extra $600 a month, plus the cost of after-school care. In the Ballard neighborhood of Seattle, the after-school program had a wait list of 3 years. A week's worth of care, 3.5 hours a day, cost just under $500. At a YMCA in Kansas, a week's worth of care, around 3 hours a day, still costs $105. It's very expensive, in other words, for both parents to work outside the home. the national average cost for childcare, according to one advocacy group, is nearly $8,700 a year. In some states, the average cost for a year of preschool care is roughly $13,000. Overall, childcare costs for a family with a working mother went up 70% from 1985 to 2012. It's even more of a hardship for single parents. On average, 36% of a single parent's income is devoted to paying others to take care of their children. Of course, families do make it work. They make it work by hodgepodging shifts, by relying on friends and family, by getting into gig work, by neglecting savings, or allowing their student loans to go into forbearance. But not everyone has reliable friends or available family. And gig work is not the same as full-time employment, which is why some mothers who'd like to be in the workplace see no other option than to quit. For years, the accepted wisdom was that a woman would stay home during a child's early years, then return to the workplace, if she wished, when the child reached later school age. But with childcare costs so much lower, that decision was rarely an economic imperative. It was just what many middle-class women did. Many millennials who grew up in those homes, myself included, watched that scenario play out with their parents. In 2015, as part of a larger story, I heard from hundreds of millennial women about what they'd internalized about having children, co-parenting, and jobs from watching their boomer moms. They talked about hard work and multitasking, but they also talked about their mother's regret. I know she put off a lot of things she wanted to do in life, college, or compromised on them, her career, because she had kids, one woman who grew up in Wyoming told me. I always swore that would not be me. Some of us watched our moms emerge from divorce with non-existent career paths. Some just heard our moms talk with thinly veiled or fully unveiled regret about what became unavailable to them after leaving the workplace. Some of us saw how hard it was to make ends meet on one salary, especially when that salary went away for whatever reason. And some of us have decided to delay or not have kids. But most women I know simply decided that they'd avoid their mother's regret by doing things differently. They'd keep their careers and have kids, even if that meant most of their salary, at least in those early years, was going to childcare. At least they'd have options. As parents' time at work increased, the paradigm of what was possible or acceptable or even affordable parenting did not change with it. Wide-scale, sweeping legislation was not passed to address it. The vast majority of employers did not alter their policies to accommodate parents. Instead, the endless expectations of how to be a parent whose child would be successful and happy and reproduce or reach above their current class status, expanded. More work outside of the home begat more work at home. Let me say that again because it's truly mind-boggling. Instead of being easier on ourselves as parents, given all of the shifts and expectations at work and our increasingly fraught class position and the massive amounts of debt we've incurred in order to maintain that class position, we allowed expectations to go up. More parenting options hasn't been liberating. It's become nauseatingly claustrophobic. This was true in some fashion for boomer parents, but it's more true in more cases for millennial parents. There's more information than ever on good parenting, and thus more ways to fail at it. There's more speculation on ways you can mess up your kids, and thus more fear that you're doing it. Kids are more expensive, and families have less money to devote to them after covering essentials. Parenting practices are more public and more scrutinized. Employers might offer ostensible flexibility, but only while also requiring more work. And contradictions, options, abound. You should be involved, but not too involved. You should direct kids toward college education at all costs, even if you feel ambivalent about your own. You should cultivate your child's independence, but never leave them unsupervised. You should praise women's empowerment, even as women's work is devalued in the home. You should trumpet the benefits of diversity while obsessing over whether your child is in the right school. You should teach them healthy relationships with technology while maintaining an unhealthy relationship with your own technology. And that's if you have time in the first place to worry about any of these things. As Elizabeth Currid Halkett points out, to actually talk about the nuances and choices of motherhood, rather than simply being a mother and taking care of one's children, implies the luxury to do so. Modern parenting has always, in some way, been about doubting your own competence. But never before has that doubt arrived with such force from so many vectors. Like all expectations, ideals, and ideologies, the question of who's actually enforcing these parenting standards is a knotty one. No one likes them, and yet there they remain, providing a sort of informal parenting surveillance state, manifesting gossip and passive-aggressive Facebook comments and well-intentioned mom support group chatter. At least that's the case amongst the bourgeois, the solidly upper middle class, the largely white population that functions as the true originator and arbiter of these norms, the yardstick against which contemporary parenting is measured and found wanting. It doesn't matter if you don't have the extra income to buy organic food, or to set aside money to pay for a college fund, or to provide constant after-school supervision. It doesn't matter if your refusal is principled or financially motivated. If you want different things for yourself or your kids, to refuse to strive is to declare yourself, in the eyes of society at large, as a willfully bad parent. Take the much-debated subject of breastfeeding, a best mothering practice, vaunted, at least in part, because it is free, and, barring medical difficulties, theoretically available to all mothers. But access to a lactation consultant isn't free. Neither are the pumps, nursing pads, bottles, mini fridges, and special bras and tops that make long-term nursing a reality for mothers who cannot be with their children throughout the day. Nursing takes massive amounts of time, a luxury many working mothers, especially poor ones, simply do not have. According to Cynthia Colin, a sociologist of public health, only 12% of female workers and 5% of female low-wage workers have access to any sort of paid leave. As a result, most women are required to forego income in order to breastfeed. Or, after breastfeeding, there is an expectation to provide children with a healthy diet. The sociologist Caitlin Daniel found that poor parents knew exactly what types of food were healthiest for their kids. But as any parent knows, introducing new foods and broadening a child's palate requires a significant amount of wasted food, which, when your food budget is governed by food stamps, is a huge risk. Daniel spotlights one poor mother from her research who attempted, the best she could, to provide healthy food on a budget, including seeking out bruised vegetables she could purchase at a discount, which she'd pair with rice, beans, or pasta. These meals cost relatively little if they're eaten, Daniel explains. But when her children rejected them, an affordable dish became a financial burden. Grudgingly, this mother resorted to the frozen burritos and chicken nuggets that her family preferred. It's not that poor parents don't know what good parenting looks like. It's that various forces make it unavailable to them. For white middle-class people, a refusal to participate in such practices can entail social ostracization. But for a Black or brown parent, such a refusal contributes to social stigma, the idea that your entire race is lazy or ignorant. And in some cases, it can be used as evidence of criminal neglect. In 2014, a South Carolina woman allowed her 9-year-old daughter out of school for the summer to play at a popular park while she was at work. Before, she'd allowed her daughter to play on a laptop in the space where she worked. But when the laptop was stolen, her daughter asked to go to the park instead. When an adult at the park asked where her mother was, she replied, "Work." The woman called the police. The mother was arrested for unlawful conduct toward a child, and her daughter was placed in temporary foster care. It's the same story in many ways as the UC Irvine professor who allowed her son to go to the playground after school. But the consequences were markedly different. The professor just had to deal with a passive-aggressive email to her husband and a call from the principal. The South Carolina woman was charged with a crime and had her child taken from her. And those differences had everything to do with race and class. The South Carolina mother is Black, and her child was at the park while she worked at McDonald's. The professor is white and, well, a professor. everyone ostensibly has the right to figure out how to parent, so long as it doesn't directly endanger the child. But in our current society, white middle-class people still set the standards around what sorts of parenting is best. Just because the rules make winning impossible doesn't mean these parents can't force everyone, themselves included, to play past the point of exhaustion. Burnout occurs when the distance between the ideal and the possible lived reality becomes too much to bear. That's true of the workplace, and that's true of parenting. The common denominator amongst millennials, then, is that we've been inculcated with the idea that that failure, like our failure to find secure employment, or save enough money to buy a house, or stave off an avalanche of medical debt, can be chalked up to simply not trying hard enough. As the sociologist Veronica Titchener puts it, work hasn't changed. Workplaces still act like everyone has a wife at home. Everyone should be the ideal worker and not have to leave to take care of a sick kid. If one family struggles to balance it all, it's a personal problem. All these families with the same problem, that's a social issue. And yet, we continue to treat this social issue as a personal issue. More specifically, a mother's issue. Women have long been freighted with the task of reconciling or soothing the anxieties that accompany societal change. And contemporary mothers are no different. When women began to move into the professional workplace, the resultant anxiety over motherless children and unkempt homes and feminized stay-at-home fathers had to be quelled in some way, lest a backlash erase whatever small progress had been made. The tacit agreement: women could enter the workplace, but only if they fulfilled every other societal expectation. They could be ambitious, but they still had to be nice, powerful, but still hot, hardworking, but still a good cook, multitasking, but still a conscientious housekeeper, a leader, but still feminine, a workaholic, but still a devoted parent. To be clear, many of these expectations were foisted on boomer moms as well. But there was less of an expectation to perform and package all of those qualities online for mass consumption. Men participate in and reinforce these ideals, but the primary arbitrators of success or failure are other women. That's one of the most noxious elements of patriarchal control. It turns the very women it subjugates into the primary enforcers of its ideology. And it manifests most vividly in what many women described, in various forms of disgust, as competitive martyrdom. White, waspy women seem addicted to martyrdom as a parenting philosophy, Kylie, a white woman from Chicago, told me. From buying all the things to the tyranny of breastfeeding to the baby gaining weight, there are endless ways to feel guilty. I think we are quick to make it as hard as possible for ourselves instead of just living. Operating in this way, constantly re-inscribing the same standards that make life so unneededly hard, is psychologically fucked, but it's also just flat-out exhausting. Even more so when all that unprocessed frustration has nowhere to go but toward competition with other moms. Instead of offering a legitimate show of community or problem-solving, moms almost universally will try to one-up your source of parenting frustration with their own similar but clearly much worse struggles, Lauren, who calls herself a broke white college student in the Pacific Northwest, explained. We could easily offer each other an exchange of hosting playdates while one takes a few hours of alone time, but then we'd be admitting that we need help and are clearly not up to the task of parenting. Better to cling to the torch of martyrdom with a white-knuckled death grip. Katie, who lives in a New England suburb, sees the ethos of self-sacrifice intertwined with what she calls Instagram parenting. When you post all the beautiful stuff, great vacations, smiling kids, and never the craziness. Except for when you do post or blog about the craziness, then it has to be emphasized. Instagram and Facebook have become the primary means through which friends and family keep track of family. It's a place to document the always well-lit, very cute every day. But it's engineered to showcase the spectacular. The trips, the fancy birthday parties, the most adorable outfits, the most together familyness. Sasha, a white upper-middle-class mom from Brooklyn, describes the Instagram mom as the cool, composed mom who keeps a super-organized calendar with the family's appointments, wants to have exciting sex no matter what time the kids went to sleep, can compartmentalize work and home and never lets her kids watch TV or eat cereal for dinner. But Instagram parenting is just the contemporary manifestation of the cult of busyness, which the communication scholar Anne Burnett has been tracking for years vis-a-vis family holiday letters, the long descriptive summaries of a family's year sent around the holidays. As she amassed more and more, she noticed a trend in the way the authors of the letters, almost always mothers, were framing their family's lives as an endless, packed, frenetic stream of busyness. She began to realize that they were, in fact, competing. "It's about showing status," Burnett told Brigitte Schulte, author of Overwhelmed, "that if you're busy, you're important. You're leading a full and worthy life." Busyness, in other words, as a very certain sort of class. There's a common denominator here between all the Instagram momming and the mommy martyrdom. It's work, all of it. First, you erase it by making motherhood look hectic but easy. Such an adventure, but always beautiful and effortless. Then, because it's not okay not to work, you emphasize it to clarify to yourself and your partner and your family and your peers just how much you actually are working. It's contradictory, and managing that contradiction, on top of all of the perfect parenting and exasperating sacrifice, just creates more work. The labor compounds in a way that makes you so exhausted you don't have energy to resist it, even when you know it's nonsense. Celia, who identifies as Latina and disabled, lives in an urban Midwest city with her husband and their child. "So many of the demands seem like housewife busy work to me," she said. "Never let your child see a screen just means you can never empty a dishwasher or wash your hair without an ordeal. Or the idea that if you sleep train your child, it'll damage your relationship with them forever. Or that you should do baby-led weaning, because if you feed your child purees, they will never have a developed palate and will become fat from eating from pouches, even though you don't have time to make tiny diced food." Celia can articulate all of this clearly, and yet still admits to feeling terrified every day that she's messing up her child in some way. Many women can list in detail the bevy of tasks, attitudes, and habits that accompany good motherhood. And then, in the same sentence, admit there are simply not enough hours in the day to even come close to doing them all. And yet women who can, try. It's the millennial way. If the system is rigged against you, just try harder. Which helps explain one of the most curious stats of the last 40 years. Women with jobs spend just as much time parenting as stay-at-home mothers did in the 1970s. The metaphor of the second shift isn't a metaphor at all. They are doing two full-time jobs. And in order to make time for both of those jobs, they are sleeping less and spending far, far less time on themselves or their own leisure. Indeed, they are spending more time on the new domesticity, best manifest in what Rachel, who parents her five-year-old with her wife outside of Memphis, calls goddamn motherfucking Pinterest. "Out of the four semi-healthy items my kid eats, I'm supposed to make edible butterflies for her lunch every day," she says. "Then there are dress-up days at school, wholesome crafts that are supposed to improve fine motor skills while avoiding screen time, and the need for everything to have a theme. If a traditional leisure activity like, say, knitting is actually pleasurable, mothers feel pressure to monetize it." Erica, who lives in a Boston suburb and describes her family as struggling financially, finds herself endlessly reading articles on Pinterest such as 21 totally legit side hustles for stay-at-home moms. "I'm constantly wondering if I could start a knitting business," she says, "instead of just relaxing with a hobby I get pleasure out of." Time studies find that a mother, especially one who works outside the home for pay, is among the most time-poor humans on the planet, Schulte writes in Overwhelmed. Especially single mothers, weighed down not only by role overload, but also what sociologists call task density, the intense responsibility she bears and the multitude of jobs she performs in each of those roles. Marielle Klone, who studies family time use in the Netherlands, explains the problem to Schulte as role overload, the constant switching from one role to the next. In 5 minutes, a mom can go from texting a friend who's been struggling, to chopping fruit for a kid's snack, to checking a recipe online, to regulating a sibling argument in the next room, to trying to listen to her partner tell her about their day at work. Whatever leisure time remains is increasingly spent with or constantly interrupted by children. Women exercise with their children. Women socialize with their children. I'm so desperate for alone time that I stay up far later than I should, just in an attempt to have moments to myself. Katie, who lives outside of Atlanta, explained, I wind up making myself more exhausted by trying to take time for myself. Marie is white, identifies as middle class, and lives in Pomona, California with her husband, who's Indian, and her mother-in-law. She finds herself constantly arguing about the length of her shower. My husband will complain that I'm in the bathroom for 30 or 45 minutes, and I realize that what I really mean when I say I want to take a shower is that I want some time for myself, to groom, to relax, to think. If you work outside of the home, there's guilt that you're not using any leftover time to spend with your children. Amy, who works as a full-time librarian, was shocked at how difficult it was to return to her job, which often requires working on nights and weekends. I put a lot of pressure on myself to make the most of the time we get to spend together, and I feel guilty taking any time for myself that I could be spending with my son, she says. Alternately, time away from parenting is spent talking about parenting. I don't want to talk about my kids and their problems when I'm out with my neighbors or friends, Christine, who lives in Atlanta, says. I have a life outside my kids and other interests. My mother definitely didn't spend time at block parties discussing my activities, and I'm there doing that. Husbands get out of that BS. Of course, contemporary fathers are expected to be present, to be involved, but the standards are far less exacting. My husband doesn't have to strive and excel and constantly pursue improvement to be considered a great professor and husband and father and community member, Brooke, who's white and middle class and lives in rural North Carolina, explains. And maybe I don't have to either, but I constantly feel like I do. The most bullshit thing is the constant never enoughness. Dads, by contrast, can find enoughness by aspiring to a level of involvement best summarized as more than what their own fathers did. That can run the spectrum from simply learning to change a diaper to taking on the role of full-time stay-at-home parent. On average, it still looks like 35% of the labor, even if the dads themselves don't want to admit it. 41% of fathers believe their childcare responsibilities were shared equally. As Darcy Lockman puts it in All the Rage, Mothers, Fathers, and the Myth of Equal Partnership, reports of the modern, involved father have been greatly exaggerated. The culture of fatherhood has changed, but that doesn't mean that fathers, even those committed to equality before the arrival of children, are enacting it in the home. A 2015 study by the Families and Work Institute found that only 35% of employed millennial men without children believed in traditional family roles, that men should be breadwinners and women should be caregivers. For those who already have kids, that number jumped to 53%. As Alyssa, who identifies as Hispanic, white, and Native American, put it, I didn't know my progressive husband was not progressive until it came to the actual division of parenting tasks. There are myriad explanations for this unequal distribution of labor. Men aren't as good at multitasking. Men don't breastfeed and thus can't take the same sort of caregiving role in early infancy. Women have unrealistic expectations for how men should complete tasks. Lockman methodically breaks down and disabuses readers of each notion. Men are not naturally bad at multitasking, for example. Men are conditioned not to have to be multitaskers. Women are conditioned to be multitaskers. Everything we call a sex difference. If you take a different perspective, what's the power angle on this? Often explains things. The neuroscientist Lise Elliott tells Lockman. It has served men very well to assume that male-female differences are hardwired. Which isn't to entirely fault men. Like women, most have few models of truly equitable partnerships. Once patterns of caregiving and expertise in that care are established, it's extremely difficult to alter them. But even men who do attempt to do their share of the household labor, switching off on bedtimes, taking on the laundry, still seldom carry what can feel like the heaviest burden of all, the mental load. The mental load, as the French cartoonist Emma describes, is carried by the person in the family, almost always a woman, who takes on a role akin to household management project leader. The manager doesn't just complete chores. They keep the entire household schedule in their minds. They're ultimately responsible for the health of the family, the upkeep of the home and their bodies, maintaining a sex life, cultivating an emotional bond with their children, overseeing aging parents' care, making sure bills are paid and neighbors are greeted, and someone's home for a service call and holiday cards get in the mail, and vacations are planned 6 months in advance, and airline miles aren't expiring, and the dog's getting exercise. The load is so heavy, made more so by the fact that no matter how many tasks you finish, it never seems to get any lighter. Women have told me that reading Emma's cartoon, which has gone viral many times over, brought them to tears. They'd never seen the particular work that they do described, let alone acknowledged. It's largely invisible, but it's also so incredibly difficult to, well, unload, even to the most well-meaning of partners. I call it the "you should have asked" phenomenon, Debbie, an upper-class mom in Florida, says. I love my husband and think he really is one of the good ones, but he only does things when asked. He only does dishes after dinner if I explicitly ask him to. And then he never actually gets the kitchen all the way clean. Even if I explicitly ask him to do something, I don't know if it is selective incompetence or regular incompetence, but he does it wrong. As Michael Kimmel, author of Manhood in America, described to Lockman, men find all manner of ways to opt out of equal labor. Men often tell me, "My wife gets on me all the time because I don't vacuum, and I'm watching a baseball game, and she comes in and says, 'At least you could vacuum.' So I do, and she comes back and tells me, 'I didn't do it very thoroughly.' So I just figure I won't do it anymore." I say to them, "Well, that's an interesting response. If I were your supervisor at work, and I assigned you a report, and I wasn't happy with what you turned in, and I told you so, would your reply be, 'Well, then, I'll never do that again'?" When I've recounted that story, in person or online, some respond that the problem lies in viewing one partner, the mother, as the boss, and the other, the father, as an employee. It's true, this is not an ideal scenario. But it's what happens when one partner is reluctant or actively refuses to perform equal labor in the home. Men find ways of being so difficult that it's not worth it, the sociologist Lisa Wade explains. So many women reconcile themselves to accept the inequality. "There is no fair in motherhood," a friend told me. "You'll drive yourself insane if you try. I just try to focus on what I need to be a whole person and then let the imbalance go as much as I can." You feel grateful that he's one of the better ones, even though this posture, as Lockman writes, conceals a sort of female subordination that would otherwise be intolerable in many 21st century homes. "He's happy to do it if I ask" is yet another task. It's not a partnership. Many women feel that because they have it better than others, they have no right to complain. Lockman borrows relative deprivation theory from sociology to explain this reticence. Only when one feels more deprived than other members of her reference group will she feel entitled to adamant protest. "Your partner's not the worst. He's doing more than his father, or than your friend's husband, who's really the worst." As Sarah, a middle-class mom from Washington, D.C., put it to me, "Our division of labor is 70-30, and I consider myself lucky," which is bullshit. Jill, who lives in a Midwest suburb, fought hard for a 55-45 split. "It took a lot of arguments and discussions to get to this point, and even now it's not quite even," she said. "But I know I have a better parenting partnership than most everyone else I know, so I don't dare push my luck much farther." That structural problems are worse for people with less money or less help or less flexibility also makes some women feel ungrateful if they voice the ways in which the system still makes them feel like shit. "This is where I really hate myself," Sarah, an upper-middle-class woman from a Midwestern suburb, explained. "We are very privileged. We have fairly secure jobs. We make over $200,000 a year, and we have minimal debt. I feel like I'm not allowed to complain about burnout because so many people have it worse than I do. I'm not scrimping or worrying about bills. I feel so guilty for complaining, so I keep a lot of my rage." Just because inequality is not as dire does not mean that it is not felt. I could talk for hours about burnout and how I feel every fucking day that I'm failing, Renee, who's middle class and lives in New Jersey, told me. I get mad at everyone who has family help and support. And I have hated my husband like never before because so much of the day-to-day and bigger scope is on me. We both work full-time, but it's on me. I'm just so, so angry. Rage seems to flare particularly wildly during periods of partner leisure. The most telling difference in our partnership is the amount of time I do not sit on the weekends versus the amount of time he sits, Sarah from the suburbs of Philadelphia explained, and naps. Lockman points to an abundance of research on men's leisure privilege. Working mothers with preschool-aged children, for example, are 2.5 times more likely to be the one to get up with their kid in the middle of the night. Fathers of infants spend twice as much weekend time in leisure than mothers of infants. I'm reminded of a friend who, as the father of a newborn, spent at least one day of each fall weekend tailgating and attending a football game, and was indignant that his wife didn't want him doing it on both Saturday and Sunday. It's not a question of whether fathers deserve leisure time. It's that many regard that leisure time as a right, even as a mother's leisure time dwindles to nothing. Sometimes the rage accumulates gradually, as you realize that a decision meant to benefit the family is mostly benefiting your partner. Jennifer, who lives in the suburban South, identifies as a queer cisgendered woman and was married to a straight cisgendered man for the first 4 years of parenting. Before they had children, she thought he'd make a good parent. Like so many other husbands, he articulated a desire to evenly split the labor of children between them. When they had their first child, her husband was in med school, and Jennifer, who is trained as a lawyer, found a flexible job with a relatively low hourly requirement, which allowed her to take on the majority of domestic labor. Later, when they struggled to find childcare that fit her hours, she was forced to quit. It seemed like the right choice for our family, she explained, even though it meant basically abandoning my legal career. But the more she gave up her working life, the more she had to do at home, especially after the birth of their second child. Expectations of what I did only went up, and contributions from my partner only went down, as he insisted he was too tired to help. He refused to get up at any point if one of the children woke up in the middle of the night, insisting he needed a full night's sleep for work. The guiding logic of this scenario is, in many ways, well-intentioned and reproduced in homes across the country that would reject the label of traditional. One parent stays home out of necessity, the other stays with their high-pressure, long-hour job with the hope that it'll one day pay dividends. You tend to defer to your spouse and just power through, Jennifer explains, with the idea that you can one day be more relaxed and comfortable and stable, with the hope that they won't divorce you before that happens. Jennifer's husband, like many partners of those who work at home, viewed all domestic care as her job. But as Jennifer points out, it was a job that didn't pay, that required her to be on call 24/7, and had no breaks. And if she asked for his help or didn't get something done, the assumption that she just wasn't working hard enough hung there, unspoken, in the air. Was she taking naps while he was at work? Watching too much television? She felt untrusted and unvalued, and most of all, exhausted. I saw this dynamic play out in my own marriage. Even though I had been the breadwinner of the home for several years and was the one with better immediate job prospects, Jennifer said. But I've also seen it play out among my friends, many of whom are still married because they do not know how they could function otherwise. It doesn't matter how mad or tired you feel, after all, when it seems like you have no other options. And it's hard for others to understand why you're so mad and tired when they don't see that your work, in or outside the home, has value. Economic insecurity makes parents insecure. What they do to fight against that insecurity tends to depend on their current class and, by extension, the level of insecurity they experience. There's a difference between worrying over whether your kid will have enough food for the week, for example, and worrying that your kid can't go to the same expensive college prep summer camp as their friends. In practice, both strategies are informed by and produce burnout. But it's a particular sort of exhaustion to be poor. It's exhausting to be stigmatized by society, to navigate social programs intended to help that mostly shame. A social worker once told me that he feels that American bureaucracy for aid is intentionally and endlessly tedious as a means to deter those who need it most. All the decisions and multitasking that are already hard to juggle when you're well-nourished and have a safe and consistent place to live become immeasurably more difficult when you don't have those elements in place. Researchers have found that poverty imposes a cognitive load on the poor. There's so much mental energy devoted to finding and maintaining the basics of life that there's little left over to, say, research, save, register, and attend night school, let alone find the energy to do the homework. Paying bills on time is a struggle for people who are middle class and burnt out. Think of how much harder it is when you don't have a computer or the extra money for a stamp. In Scarcity, Why Having So Little Means So Much, the economist Sendhil Malanathan and the psychologist Eldar Shafir breaks down the ways in which scarcity captures the mind. As Shafir explained in an interview with CityLab, when your bandwidth is loaded, in the case of the poor, you're just more likely to not notice things. You're more likely to not resist things you ought to resist. You're more likely to forget things. You're going to have less patience, less attention to devote to your children when they come back from school. Poor parents don't arrive at burnout. They've never left it. Lorraine, who's white and identifies as lower class, became a stay-at-home mom when she and her husband couldn't afford childcare. They're getting a deal on rent, but depend heavily on family and food stamps to get by. I can't afford to take my daughter to toddler classes, and we don't get to go on trips, she says. I constantly worry about having enough diapers, and there's limited public transportation or walkable areas where I live. And there's many times when I don't have a car to even bring us to the park. All of it makes her feel more burnt out, especially when others in her community make comments about her daughter's normal scrapes and bruises, and connect it to the fact that she sometimes attends a home daycare or the church nursery. It doesn't matter how hard she works to try to parent right. Others will always shame her for not doing more. Nana, who identifies as Jewish Israeli and lives in a small suburb, describes constant fear, stress, anxiety, and isolation as a single parent who's poor. She chose a career path that would allow her to be with her son more, but now finds herself taking on extra work after hours to make ends meet. Work never ends, she says. Money is never a sure thing. It makes it much harder to be present for my boy. Lauren is a financially lower-class, full-time college student in the Pacific Northwest, co-parenting her two kids with her husband, who works nights and sleeps during the day. Her burnout intensifies with the added stress of trying to figure out how bills are getting paid, how to trim the budget, and how far apart ends are going to be in any given month. And when you're attempting to be middle class, but also attempting to parent a child with special needs, every task feels exponentially more difficult. You want to talk about parenting burnout? Meredith, who is white and lives outside of Pittsburgh, asked. Talk to the parents of special needs kids. We invented parenting burnout. Meredith describes burnout as the feeling of having 100 balls in the air and knowing you're going to drop some of them, but not knowing which ones and how vital they'll be and the fallout of dropping them. She is constantly trying to figure out how to fit in one more therapy for her child in their schedule, but also wondering, is the therapy worth it? Can we access it? Who must we fight to get it? Cheryl, who describes herself as white, queer, and neurodivergent, and cares full-time for her disabled children, feels like she's constantly battling the desire to give up because there's no way she can possibly do it right. What would that mean anyway, she asks. But continuing to try too hard might literally kill me. I might keel over from exhaustion or a heart attack. Money can help relieve the symptoms of economically exacerbated burnout. But symptom relief is different from a cure. Stephanie, a Latina college professor, blames burnout for the destruction of her marriage. As she gained stability and a firmly upper middle class status, she was able to get divorced and find a therapist and avoid, in her words, flaming out. But she keeps the anxiety of financial insecurity with her. Growing up working class means I am always worried about savings and the fact that I don't think I can help my kids with much beyond college, she said. And I am still fucking tired and wake up worrying about how to pay for summer camps and braces. Upper middle class parents like Stephanie aren't worried about covering basic financial expenses. They're worried about downward mobility. If Stephanie's kids don't go to summer camp or get braces, will their chances of maintaining middle-class status go down? It might seem silly, but it's a real and motivating fear. To fall in class status is to reverse the hard-earned upward mobility of your grandparents, your parents, or yourself. It feels abjectly un-American, which is why so many parents drive themselves deeper into burnout to avoid it. Take the example of Casey, who lives in the outer suburbs of Philadelphia and identifies as white and middle class. She works as an attorney and her husband is a nurse, but they have four kids and recently declared bankruptcy. If we don't have money, how do we send our kids to camps in the summer and get tutoring for a special needs child, she asked. How do we get to birthday parties and keep social plans when we don't have the finances to do so? What they did, like millions of other people barely holding on to the middle-class lifestyle, was go deeply into debt. Meredith, a self-described overeducated white lady, articulates her burnout in terms of rage, usually over the relentlessness of the job intersecting with the relentlessness of the household, plus the obnoxious task of maintaining appearances in her neighborhood. We have to keep the house well-maintained to appease the HOA, she explained. And if the kids' friends are engaged in X activity, my husband feels guilty if our kids don't join them. So I go along with it so that my husband stops asking about X activity. But then I find myself the only one responsible for where X activity gear is stored and making sure it's clean. And then, she says, I feel bad about myself for feeling burnout over rich white lady problems because they are so trivial compared to other people's problems. Despite their economic security, Meredith says that all of her parenting decisions come from a place of, does this make it more or less likely that my kid will want to live in my basement at 30? In other words, how can they be in a place, both financially and psychologically, of independence? For Alexa, who lives in a small town in northern Idaho, her burnout decreased substantially when her family moved from the East Coast, where there was a lot more pressure to have the right things and afford private school. In Idaho, they make enough money to work less and pay extra for childcare, including a nanny. We feel secure, she said, but saving enough for college still feels very stressful. That anxiety often plays out in the form of more activities. Some middle-class millennials grew up with packed schedules, but those pale in comparison to the way middle-class millennials now feel compelled to schedule their own children, beginning as early as infancy. In The Playdate, Parents, Children, and the New Expectations of Play, Tamara R. Mose interviewed parents across New York City about playdates and the unspoken rules that guide them. It's not surprising that she found the primary instigators of playdates aren't kids, but parents, who, despite already packed schedules, always made time for playdates. Not because they took labor off the parents, in many cases, both parents were present for a playdate, but because of social connectedness or class connectedness for both the parent and the child. The transformation from going to play to playdate formalizes what was once a casual component of a child's life. It moves from child-directed, I'm going to go play over at Emily's house, to parent-appointed, with expectations of parent-guided crafts, snacks, and socialization. And because it's parent-guided, it's the parents who decide which other parents are the right ones to be socializing with. Almost always, parents of the same class, education level, and parenting style as themselves. In this way, Mose argues, the playdate becomes a primary site of elite social class reproduction, even in a place as economically diverse as New York City. Middle-class parents can be outrageously, if subconsciously, snobby, but their fear of another family's poor parenting habits is just another version of that same old class anxiety and instability. When a parent attempts to make connections with the right sort of families, what they're really trying to do is build an insurance policy that their kid will maintain those bourgeois connections, habits, and familiarity for the rest of their lives. Within this logic, spending time with the wrong kind of family is like exposure to a contagion, threatening to forever infect a child with the disease of downward mobility. Depending on a parent's place within the economic spectrum, they might expend outsized energy trying to arrange appropriate playdates, or conceal that their family might not be appropriate playdate material. Amy, a white mother who lives in Toronto, told me that she hates hosting playdates. not because of the kids themselves, but because of what might happen if the other parents knew about their class status. I fear what they will say to their parents because we are renting an apartment and don't own a proper house, she said. I stress about what to feed them so I can appear to adhere to norms around food prep. And I stress that my house isn't clean enough and that our IKEA furniture is substandard. She always offers to handle all pickups and drop-offs, creating more work for herself to make sure the other parents don't see their living situation. In an interview with Malcolm Harris, Mose herself describes the pressure, as a Black mother, to ensure her kids play the right way. I always wanted to present as a decent Black family because I know all of the stereotypes out there about Black families and Black children, she said. So I always wanted to make sure my home was clean. I always wanted to make sure that appropriate food was being offered. And appropriate, meaning organic or fruits and vegetables, not junky food or anything like that. It's labor, in other words, to prove to bourgeois white parents that your kid is worthy to associate with theirs. Harris compares the playdate to a form of private school, in which wealthier parents remove their kids from public and sequester them somewhere with a guest list and a cover charge. Which is actually a pretty great way to describe the new bourgeois kid's birthday. When I was growing up, I had a party at the roller skating rink, and another with the theme of my favorite book, The 11th Hour. My mom still complains about it, but I was the one directing these parties and making the invite lists. The contemporary party, especially for young children, is almost laughably transparent in its attempt at class reproduction. The birthday party is not necessarily for the child, although many attempt to portray the party as being about the birthday child, Mose writes. Instead, it's a manifestation of panic, a need to maintain the mother's identity and role in the community, and to display economic advantage and thus class advantage. On Big Little Lies, a show ostensibly about murder, but actually about class maintenance, when Renata Klein, Laura Dern, learns that her husband's been arrested for fraud and their assets will be liquidated, she responds by throwing a lavish 70s-themed birthday party for her young daughter. There's no question who the party is for or what it's meant to communicate. Big Little Lies is a melodrama, but its plot hinges on only slightly outsized versions of modern parenting anxieties. I talked to a woman named Julie, who describes her family as white and upper middle class and recently moved from a town near Westchester, New York, where everyone was just too much. A typical mom purchase, sets of Yogi Bo giant pillows for the kids' playroom, cost $100 each. I just decided that I wouldn't keep up and would try to do my own thing, she said. But then, of course, my son wanted a birthday party at one of those bounce house places. We wound up spending $700 plus on a party for 12 kids. Even parents like Julie, who try to resist participating in the social ritual of birthdays, get drawn in. Little kids, after all, just think they're going to a party, not a thinly veiled demonstration of class insecurity that makes every adult involved quietly hate themselves. If parenting, like work and technology, has become this hard, why don't we do anything about it? If it's so clearly a shared societal problem, why do we continue to delude ourselves into thinking it's a personal failure? Take the example of affordable, dependable childcare. It's ridiculously stressful to find. If it's dependable, it's rarely affordable. If it's affordable, it's rarely dependable. The stress of childcare routinely prompts one parent to unwillingly quit a job they love. It prompts other parents to work far more hours than they'd prefer just to cover the costs. Affordable, universally available childcare for young children, but also for children who need care in the hours before and after school, would be revelatory. It would lift a profound burden off so many parents and mothers in particular. We subsidize farmers. We subsidize local business development. We flat out fund public schooling. So why hasn't it happened? There seem to be two interlocking and deeply depressing reasons. Men still don't value domestic labor as labor, and men predominate our legislative bodies and the vast majority of our corporations. They don't treat contemporary parenting, its cost, or the burnout that accompanies it as a problem, let alone a crisis, because they cannot or refuse to empathize with it. Whether or not these legislators identify as conservatives or pro-woman or even feminist doesn't matter. What matters is that it has not become a legislative or corporate priority. And while there are women in politics in the business world who do advocate for these policies, either they do not occupy the positions of power to enforce them, or if they do, they often use their platforms to demonstrate that change isn't needed. Marissa Mayer, formerly the CEO of Yahoo, famously refused to take more than 2 weeks of maternity leave after giving birth to her first child, a symptom of a work culture that will not accommodate the realities of parenthood, but also a symptom of her willingness to operate by and implicitly strengthen that same culture. There are exceptions, of course. Patagonia has led the way in establishing subsidized on-site childcare. At the Gates Foundation, every employee received a full year of parenting leave, which was recently cut to 6 months, plus $20,000 to pay for childcare costs. But solutions on the corporate level are not enough. As we've seen, the fissuring of the marketplace ensures they'll only extend to a certain class and echelon of worker. Relief from parenting burnout shouldn't be a middle-class privilege. After all, if you offer relief exclusively to the upper middle class, the fear of falling to the lower class will remain. Put differently, you can get rid of the childcare cost, but that doesn't mean you'll get rid of the endless class performance birthday parties or Instagramming perfection. The causes are systemic, which is why the solutions have to be holistic. It's straightforward, really. Change the fundamental arrangement in which parenting occurs, and you'll change the way parenting feels. Which is why the solution to parenting burnout won't come from books like Mommy Burnout, written by a psychologist and family therapist, or Girls Stop Apologizing, by an empowerment expert like Rachel Hollis. Those books address the symptoms of exhaustion. You don't have to be perfect, ditch the mom guilt, but avoid the larger structural causes of that exhaustion. As Lockman very convincingly argues, one of the main ways to set a family up for enduring, equitable distribution of labor is when the non-birth parent takes significant leave, preferably alone. During that time, the labor that would otherwise stay invisible, including, most importantly, the labor of carrying the mental load, becomes visible. But that takes policy change. You can't fix parenting burnout by making time for Bible study or journaling in the morning, as Jessica Turner suggests in Fringe Hours, or by learning how to fight like an adult, as Jancy Dunn argues in How Not to Hate Your Husband After Kids. You can't fix it with self-care, a concept originated by Audre Lorde to describe how to give oneself space to recover from the exhausting battle of fighting systemic oppression, then co-opted by privileged white women to grant permission to escape many of the standards and schedules they've wittingly or not helped perpetuate. You can make yourself temporarily feel better, but the world will still feel broken. Parenting is never going to be free of worry or comparison or stress. But there can be significantly less of all of those things. To make that happen, we have to admit that it's not enough to have progressive ideals about parenting. Our current iteration of patriarchal capitalism destroys those ideals, no matter how earnest or deeply held, and replaces them with the regressive opposite: dramatically unequal distribution of domestic labor, generalized undervaluing of women's labor, and jobs engineered to favor those unburdened with primary childcare responsibilities. That doesn't mean that making time for journaling or going to therapy to work on labor distribution with your partner or venting with friends won't make you feel better. But it won't make life for other parents or your kids when they become parents easier. I find myself returning to one of the best pieces of advice I've received about how to actually reduce burnout. Think not just about how to reduce your own, but how your own actions are sparking and fanning burnout in others. That's useful advice for any male partners reading this chapter, but it's useful for everyone, no matter how burnt out you find yourself, and regardless of your status as a parent. If you want to feel less exhausted, less resentful, less filled with unspeakable rage, less ground down to the thinnest, least likable version of yourself, then you have to act, vote, and advocate for solutions that will make life better not just for you, or for people who look and speak and act like you and have families like yours, but for everyone.